Hello, it's Thursday 7th of May, Wusak Day for Buddhists around the world. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Czech in Asia.
On today's show, we're deliberately avoiding both the dreaded C word and discussion about the future of tourism. Instead, we're taking a look at 8 intriguing travel-related stories in our region that you may have missed over the last 4 months of 2020.
So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today, we are rewinding through 8 thought-provoking travel and tourism stories in Southeast Asia that went slightly under the radar so far in 2020.
Yeah, Hannah, the media agenda and the public debate across all spheres, not just travel and tourism, has been dominated by that dreaded C word since early January. However, there have been some other interesting low-key developments across our region, which may, hopefully may, point the way forwards. But before we start, Hannah, it's been a busy week with a gradual lifting of movement restrictions in some countries, notably Vietnam and here in Malaysia, of course, and with tentative signs that domestic tourism and flight reopenings could be moving up the agenda. You've been hitting the webinar circuit, so tell us more about that.
Yeah. So Monday evening, so that's what, a couple of days ago now, I was on Travel Massive panel, because I'm actually the chapter leader for Travel Massive KL, not that we do an awful lot, but there we are. So not yet. We were discussing Southeast Asian tourism. It was super interesting. Guy from the Philippines was there, a guy who runs a tour operator in Thailand too. Everyone just talking about their own situation and what's happening in their countries. And then on coming Friday, so that's tomorrow, I've got another webinar, so this time on Muslim travel, so completely different, but steps that businesses can take to start welcoming Muslim travel. How about you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, it's also been a pretty busy week. I had a couple of conversations with the people from Skift. They were researching a couple of articles. One was on the potential for the Maldives to become a sort of reboot destination for people in Asia Pacific. So we discussed that one. And then yesterday we had a discussion about travel bubbles, which is obviously a very hot topic right now, and looking at how strategic partnerships between countries that are moving more quickly out of the crisis might sort of partner up and allow some degree of essential business travel, perhaps some leisure travel. But, you know, we may be a little bit away from that yet. But, you know, there's a lot of diplomatic back channeling going on about that right now. So that's one thing I've been doing. We've also been working on the Sunday Supplement, which is our new 6-part weekly article series, which goes out every Sunday. We've done 2 articles so far. The first one was, we're taking a different theme on each article. So the first one was looking at how travel and tourism, and particularly policy, is going to become much more political for some of the reasons I just discussed there, the travel bubbles. Last week's article was sort of a country case study. It was about Malaysia, because obviously Malaysia was coming out of its movement control order from Monday just gone. Yeah. So that was last week's article. This week's, which I'm currently working on, is a bit more economic based, but I haven't actually finalized it yet, but that's upcoming. And then also we did an interview this week with Mac Patel of OAG about the future of aviation here in Asia Pacific, which was fascinating. He gave us some great insights, not just here in Southeast Asia, but across the region, and how, you know, the regional role of aviation was so important globally, and, you know, what might happen to that going forward.
Yeah, I'm jealous I missed that one. It was a really good interview.
Yeah, it was. Some great insights, and obviously that one is posted up on Spotify and on our website, so, you know, please feel free to go and listen to that.
Yeah, and go check it out. So let's begin today's show in earnest. As Gary mentioned, the tentative steps being taken to reinvigorate travel in the region, you know, made us want to rewind. Since travel and tourism began to gradually shut down in our region back in January, we've been searching every month for interesting stories that normally would have gained more coverage than they actually did.
Yeah, that's right, Hannah. We launched the Southeast Asia Travel Show Cheat Sheet back in January. And each month we collate together 10 stories in a sort of easy to read, very concise format. And these stories are picked to show both the diversity and the dynamism of travel and tourism in our region.
From the outset, really, the tagline of our podcast has been discussing the hottest topics in the world's most dynamic tourism region. And over recent years, Southeast Asia has gained global attention for the way the travel sector has expanded and innovated, while surging demand for inbound, outbound and intra-regional trips saw arrivals soar to record levels in many countries.
Yeah, and although the pandemic has sort of brought that to a halt, really, by shutting down the entire infrastructure of travel, not just here in Southeast Asia, but, you know, across the globe, we still believe that the gradual but progressive recovery in our region can show the way ahead for tourism internationally. So we've trawled back over the first four issues of the Cheat Sheet to pick out eight stories that we think symbolize both the potential and the challenges ahead for travel and tourism here in Southeast Asia. So, Hannah, we're going to go back in chronological order. We're going to start in January. And what's the first pick story?
So my first pick actually from the January cheat sheet is a topic quite close to my heart, and that is Muslim tourism. And Singapore, the Singapore Tourism Board, announced that it was partnering with Crescent Rating, who are a kind of global Muslim consultancy, and Have Halal Will Travel, which is a big travel blog aimed at Muslim travelers. And they really wanted to partner with these two guys to enhance what they are offering for Muslim travelers. So they are proposing, or were proposing, they were proposing a 44-page guide to halal dining in Singapore. It was going to be in English, it was going to be in Bahasa Melayu, it was going to be in Bahasa Indonesia, with some themed online promotions trying to engage millennials and family travellers. Now, I haven't actually seen that come out yet. I think when they launched it in January, they were saying it could even come out within the next month or so. It hasn't come out yet. But for me, it's interesting because it really signals this stepping up of tourism boards to target Muslim travellers. So Singapore has clearly woken up to the fact that there's a lot of potential there. And it probably helps that both Crescent Rating and Have Halal Will Travel are both headquartered in Singapore. So they clearly have alerted STB about this potential, and now they want to try and tap into it.
Yeah, and as we, that really taps into what we were discussing just even a minute ago, you know, these potential travel bubbles that are opening up. If you look at the potential for Muslim travel within our region for Singapore, you know, there's a big opportunity there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you've got Malaysia, Indonesia, you've got Brunei, southern Thailand, southern Philippines. So even just within ASEAN, still tapping onto the Muslim travel market is a smart move to do.
Yeah, so you think we'll see, you mentioned it hasn't actually been published yet, but that probably could be one of the sort of first moves that we might see when they start promoting travel and tourism again.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, so we'll come to my first pick. This is quite close to my heart. We're looking at Bali Airport, which announced earlier in the year that it was going to build a train line between the airport and the beach town of Kuta, which is sort of tourism central in Bali. It's the biggest city. It's where most people usually take their first steps of travel in Bali. Now, this is quite an interesting project because it's actually been invested and partly developed by the Korea Rail Authority. So there's some international interest in this. It's going to be a 5-kilometer rail line that will run from the airport to Kuta town, and it's supposed to open in 2022. Now, there's obviously every chance that that's going to be delayed right now. But this is an interesting aspect, because I mean, I'm lucky enough to travel to Bali quite regularly, have an apartment there. And one of the things that you always notice whenever you arrive, at whatever time of the day, even though they expanded, well, probably this is because of the fact they expanded Bali Airport, it's much bigger now than it used to be. So there's a lot of people go through there, especially at peak times. But getting a taxi or finding your way to Kuta is quite difficult. It's not very far. The roads are very narrow. They're very old roads as well. You get long delays. Often there are long traffic queues. And during rainy season, that road floods pretty badly. So there is definitely, there's been for a long time, a need to develop another way of actually accessing Kuta. Another of the problems is, although there are ride-hailing options from Bali Airport, you Grab and I think Gojek as well, until recently, it was quite difficult to find the pickup point. It wasn't particularly well highlighted. It was much easier to find the official taxi rank. I think that's changed a little bit recently. They have actually put some signage up to make it easier. But even so, just because of the nature of that road traffic, having a train line would save time, energy, and probably a lot of stress for travelers arriving and departing from Bali.
Yeah, good news then. Woohoo, let's hope they do keep to 2022.
That would be great, yeah.
Third pick then, and this is from February, is that India is going to start a 579-kilometre route across the border to Myanmar, to Mandalay. So it will connect Mandalay and Myanmar with Imphal, which is the capital of India's Manipur state. And that's interesting as well, because that will be a way for Myanmar to focus on boosting tourism arrivals from India, you know, particularly overland. And of course, Myanmar where it is, you know, geographically, it's between Southeast Asia and South Asia, really. It's got that land border with India. So this, you know, it makes sense geographically, but politically, it's also a bit of a triumph because it's been 17 years that they've taken to negotiate and plan this cross-border bus route.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, when you look at it, if you look at the geography of Myanmar and you look at the length of its border with India, it's amazing that there wasn't a route before. I mean, I know there are a lot of political and reasons for this, and obviously the conflict in northern Myanmar hasn't helped either. But it is quite astonishing. And as you say, this really potentially, the actual bus route has been delayed, obviously, because of COVID-19. But, you know, that offers an opportunity to bring much more Indian tourism across the border, especially short trip visits. And it comes at a time also, this is some other work that I've been doing recently, when China has been investing quite significantly in travel transportation in Myanmar. There was talk that China was going to build a high-speed railway through Myanmar. That has been shelved for the current time. But obviously both countries, India and China, are going to make a play for political influence in Myanmar. In some ways, that benefits Myanmar because it can play those two countries off each other. And, you know, it should hopefully in future really benefit its tourism industry. But it does need those access routes because even though it has quite good airports now, Yangon Airport has been developed. Mandalay Airport is still relatively small, but it has capacity strength there. The number of flights in and out of the two major countries that it borders is still relatively low. So there's a lot of opportunities. And if you can bring people in across the border, like we said just there, you have the opportunity for short stay tourism. People can come in and come out. You know, short stay tourism tends to have quite a high spending coefficient.
I mean, and that probably brings us nicely also onto number four, which is another story from Myanmar that came out in February, that it tops the global travel growth. So arrivals to Myanmar last year actually expanded 40.2% in 2019. So it made it to number one on the UNWTO's tourism growth rankings list. So that's pretty interesting. And I mean, things were shaping up for it to be a great year for Myanmar this year. Let's see how it goes. But I mean, other Southeast Asian nations who also made it to this top 10 were Vietnam. In seventh place, they had 18.2% growth year on year, and Philippines were eighth, so that went up 15.1%. So Southeast Asia was doing pretty well last year.
It was, and I mean, the case for Myanmar, I mean, obviously the percentage growth is so high because it was coming off a relatively low base, but the interesting of those three countries that you mentioned there, Myanmar, Vietnam, and the Philippines, they're all big countries. So they all have pretty diverse opportunities to grow different aspects of their tourism industries. Myanmar has huge growth potential. It's an absolutely beautiful country. Every time I go there, you know, the people are wonderful. The cultures are, as you said earlier, Hannah, it is a real crossing point between Southeast Asia, South Asia, and also Northeast Asia as well, because it borders China. It is a real meeting point, and it, you know, that is really reflected in the cultures, the cuisines, and also the landscapes. You know, it does have a lot of internal problems, these conflicts. It has an election coming up this year, which may mean more social unrest. But, you know, we really do hope it comes out of it because the potential for that country in terms of tourism is amongst the highest in the region, I would say.
Bold words.
So let's move to a country that, well, it's still outside of ASEAN. It hasn't yet joined ASEAN, but East Timor has been applying to become a member of ASEAN, which is the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, for almost a decade now, since 2011. And it had been hoping that this year would be the year that it actually became the 11th member state of ASEAN. That could still happen, but obviously the diplomatic processes have been completely changed this year because of COVID-19. So it may be that decision will be shelved. But, you know, there are opportunities here. East Timor also has huge tourism potential. It's obviously quite a raw destination. Infrastructure is pretty low grade at the moment. But, you know, you are seeing some travelers going in there that is particularly on the sort of backpacker route and those that are traveling in the eastern part of Indonesia. Because it's easier to access from there. There's also an opportunity for travel from northern of Australia as well. So there are huge opportunities, but obviously it's got to become a member of ASEAN first. Once it does that, it then becomes, you know, it can then engage with a lot of the mechanisms that ASEAN has for developing tourism regionally as well as just between member states. So there are opportunities. Let's hope that happens. I think most of the ASEAN states want this to happen. There have been issues about East Timor's GDP per capita, but the only real way that it can grow that is to become part of this economic group and the ASEAN economic community. So, you know, there's opportunities and there's a chance for it to grow. Let's hope it's given that chance.
All right, our fifth choice out of the cheat sheet comes from March, and it's about the fact that we're always talking about having a high-speed rail between Singapore and China, but that's actually becoming a little bit closer to reality now. So in March, the Thai government announced it was going to spend $21 billion to expand the mass transit system, extend the train network, and build more high-speed railway links. So they are actually talking now to design the link between Thailand and Laos, to the Chinese railway in Laos.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk, there's been a lot of diplomatic work and a lot of potential investment in building this trans-ASEAN high-speed railway, which would link Yunnan province, which is landlocked in China, and run all the way through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia. Potentially, it would also connect up with Malaysia, and if Kuala Lumpur and Singapore ever come to terms with building their high-speed rail, it would take it right to the bottom of the peninsula. And it's going to be done in phases. We don't know what will happen after COVID-19, because COVID-19 is really constraining government finances. So the ability to actually invest and build these railway networks is going to be difficult. But the first phase, which goes from Yunnan province into Laos, is well underway. That's been going for, I think, about a couple of years now. So they're moving that up, and that will move up to the Cambodian border. So, you know, you should be seeing, maybe next year, Chinese tourists should be coming into Laos by a railway and the other way as well. But the connective parts to take it through Thailand and further down into the Malay Peninsula, that's going to take time. And I honestly don't think that's going to be a priority in the immediate period after the pandemic.
No, though it would be interesting to see what take-up is like, won't it, from China to Laos by rail, if people see trains as a slightly safer option than travelling by plane.
Yeah, it will, because you know the high-speed railway network in China, obviously that's grown so fast in the last 13 years, and it's very popular. You know, people do travel interstate, intercity, even on short trips. It's fast, it's efficient, and you know, it's not actually cheap. It's priced similar to price to airlines, but Chinese airspace is such that, you know, you have so many delays on flights there that the railway is much more punctual. I don't see any reason why Laos will not grow its inbound numbers quite significantly once it's open.
Good. Some hope.
Some hope. So that takes us from the railways to the airways. So one of the stories that appeared in March the story appeared, I think, in February, was the Air Asia, which is the largest low-cost carrier in our region, had become embroiled in a controversy that related to a serious fraud office case in the UK, which was brought against Airbus. It was a bribery case, and it related to issues about the sale of planes to specific airlines around the world. It wasn't just AirAsia. And after that case happened, the two senior executives of AirAsia stepped down from their positions while it was investigated. Now, this went on for a little while. It had a big effect on AirAsia's share price. Yeah. This was also happening at the time where COVID-19 was just starting to have an impact. AirAsia has a lot of vulnerability to China because there's so many flights in and out, and they were obviously shut down. So the actual revenues for the airline were, you know, they were dropping at the same time as well. But both the CEO and the chairman of AirAsia were actually cleared by an independent panel, which happened after this, and they've now taken back up their position. So they're at the helm of AirAsia again as they try to navigate the way forward into an era where, you know, they'll hopefully be flying again, both within Malaysia, and it also has other brands around the region as well. So hopefully the future for AirAsia is a little bit brighter, but obviously, as we've been seeing recently, you know, its cash flow has been hit quite hard. We don't yet know when it'll be able to fly in different countries, but at least structurally, it's back in place.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has started its flights back up in Malaysia again, which is good. And yeah, I think Thailand, I think, has started. I think Philippines is slated for mid-month. So things are slowly coming back. But of course, that's all for essential travel only. It's not really for leisure travel. So like you say, Gary, it's still got a long way to go yet.
Yeah, it does. And as we've discussed beforehand, you know, AirAsia has been so important. It's been pivotal in the growth of travel in our region. And, you know, there's no doubt that if it can build its capacities again, it will be pivotal in some sort of recovery. So we do wish it well. It's quite a controversial airline. Not everybody is always totally in favor of some of the things that it does. But in terms of the frequencies, the velocities and the prices that it offers, it really has enabled a lot of people that wouldn't have been able to fly more frequently than they probably even would ever have hoped.
Yep. Exactly. Now everyone can fly, isn't it? That's their tagline.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now we're looking at lost treasures, Hannah. This one's for you.
Yeah. So this came out just quite recently in April. So it was in our last cheat sheet. And it's quite a nice one. So Cambodia recently had a discovery of a 6 meter long reclining Buddha carved into a hill in Pusat province. And the nice thing is it's ancient. They're not quite sure how old it is, and different experts have got different opinions. But this is something really that the Cambodian government have been trying to encourage people to do, to go and kind of try to rediscover these lost historic relics. And they believe, I think, that there are many of these lost historic sites dotted all over the country, simply as another way to encourage, you know, tourists to come in and view them, or repeat tourists to come in. And it's got real benefits for the region. I mean, especially for this particular spot in Pusat province. Now, not only, you know, are they got the hope that they'll have more tourism revenue coming in and helping to kind of boost levels of education in the villages and boost just general expenditure, but they also had problems with illegal logging and poaching in the nearby jungle. And that's now actually become a lot more difficult for people to do. So it's got kind of this unintended, unexpected, lovely benefit for the locals that they're not having to contend with all of this illegal logging, which is kind of nice. It's a nice positive story for once in 2020.
Yeah, I love stories like this. I love stories when it starts to reveal what may happen in future. You find these great historic relics, and obviously they have to be restored, and you don't know when they'll be available to the people. But it's got a real Indiana Jones touch to it, this story. And I think it's one of the most positive stories that we've seen, over the past few months, because Cambodia does have really, really great historic attractions, of course. But there is so much of the country that is unexplored or only relatively explored. There's going to be great opportunities. And, you know, I have to say that if they do open this to the public, I'll be one of the first people to try and go and see it.
Nice.
And that brings us to the last story, Hannah, which is also a sort of historic theme.
Yeah, well, I do love a bit of history. So this is that Vietnamese cultural heritage experts are teaming up with Laotian experts to make the Hin Nam No National Reserve its fourth UNESCO World Heritage Site. So this is located in the Cam Van province, and it is what they call it, a dissected karst plateau reserve. But the great thing about this is that it's home to lots of rare flora and fauna. It's got a network of limestone caves. And this joint application is because it's this region in Laos, this karst region, actually extends all the way into Vietnam. And the Phong Nha Ke Bang National Park in Vietnam has already been inscribed by UNESCO in 2003. So its kind of Laotian counterpart is also asking for it to be inscribed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site in this kind of joint listing, which I think is nice to see again, like these different tourism organizations and different cultural heritage experts from different countries teaming together to try and promote sites. I think that's really great.
Yeah, I agree. And this one came sort of on radar from Offred. I have to admit, I didn't know anything about this national park, but I've sort of been doing a bit of digging and diving around on the internet to have a look, and it looks absolutely stunning. You know, it is very pristine. You know, there's not many sort of trails and tracks there. The karst looks stunning. It is completely clothed in rainforest. So yeah, I mean, you know, that's a real adventure option for the future. It's natural. It's in, you know, the fresh air, so it's away from urban centres. So, you know, if there is this move towards sort of rural and adventure tourism out in the sort of unknown parts of countries, this is really well primed for that. I guess the one issue, we've discussed this before, Hannah, is that, you know, when it becomes a UNESCO World Heritage Site, those sites tend to attract big numbers of people. You know, you always, the case that we've always discussed before is Angkor Wat. You know, it just brings so many people together at one time. And as we're moving into an era where physical distancing is going to be a part of life for a long time, you know, how do you promote a new UNESCO World Heritage Site but still keep limits on the people that can come in and the space they have to keep between each other while they're there, that's going to be pretty tricky, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that is going to be the tightrope that I imagine most sites are going to have to walk, isn't it, between getting visitors in and letting people come and see this outstanding world site, and at the same time, you know, the fear of tourists not wanting to mix around with too many other tourists too. So yeah, it will be an interesting one to see how that plays out.
Yeah, but as we said, it hasn't actually been inscribed yet. It's made an application. I think it applied last year. So sometimes those applications can take a while. But I would imagine, you know, the way that the global debate on tourism is at the moment, the natural sites like that might sort of get pushed up the agenda a little bit. So let's hope that, you know, in the next year or two, that one does get its place on the list.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
So, Hannah, that brings us almost to the end of this off-radar rewind edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yes, as we mentioned, 4 issues of our monthly Southeast Asia Travel Show cheat sheet for January, February, March and April 2020 are all available to view and download on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com.
Yes, each cheat sheet is concise and easy to read, and it's well worth a quick look. You can sign up to receive it for free each month and receive our new weekly mini briefing email newsletter as an extra bonus.
Yeah, so that's mailed out every Friday afternoon, and we take a close-up look at the unfolding travel and tourism situation in one Southeast Asian country per week. So far, we've covered the Philippines, Singapore, and Indonesia, and last week's mini briefing was a special edition covering all 10 ASEAN countries. This week, and that's tomorrow already, we're going to focus on Myanmar.
So you can sign up for free for the mini briefing and the cheat sheet on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show, or simply type a sign-up message on our Facebook page, the SEA Travel Show, or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show.
In the meantime, please continue sending us your comments, insights and thoughts for future show themes by emailing us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com.
And of course, you can also find us on Instagram at SEA Travel Show, where we regularly post images from our travels throughout Southeast Asia.
That's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to write and produce tomorrow's mini briefing, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yeah, see you soon. Bye-bye.